Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special Empire podcasts. This one is dedicated to the latest episode in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Ant-Man. And here to discuss Ant-Man with me today are two of our finest insect-loving nut jobs. First up, the Empire writer who was on set of Ant-Man in Atlanta, man. It's Nick Desemlian, man.
Hello.
Hello.
That all the above is true.
All of the above is true. It's Dan Jolin, everybody. Dan loves ants, fried, boiled, fricasseed. He doesn't care. Tasty, tasty ants.
Actually, my best recipe is antipasto.
If you're still with us after that, a quick word to the wise. As always, this is a spoiler special. We'll be discussing all the film's plot twists and third act developments in microscopic detail. So if you haven't seen Ant-Man, get on the back of an ant, fly to your nearest cinema, see Ant-Man, come back here, and listen to all the spoilery goodness. Okay, got that? We will wait. That's it. They're back now. It's all good. Before the three of us get into dissecting Ant-Man... Oh, that sounds wrong. Let's hear from the movie's director. Peyton Reed, of course, replaced Edgar Wright last year when the latter departed close to the start of production, citing creative differences with Marvel. But Reed did a fine job, I think we can all agree. And when he came to London recently, I sat down with him and talked about pretty much everything spoilerific that the movie had to offer. Do enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the director of Ant-Man, Peyton Reed. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing well.
Good, good, good. Now, you know, we're going to get into spoiler stuff. Just one question. What's happening to the end? What's the Falcon doing? Or why has Bucky got his arm trapped? And what does Cap say about Tony? Apart from that, I mean, that's not a scene you directed. That's a bona fide scene from Civil War, isn't it? That's something we're going
to... The last tag scene. Yeah, it's interesting because we knew we wanted to have a couple of tags on this movie.
Yeah.
The first one with Hank and Hope, where we reveal the Wasp costume. Mm. That was something we shot during production and was always an inherent part of the movie because it really is sort of the completion of Hope's arc in that movie.
Sure.
The second one, we actually cut some tags to go on the end that had nothing to do with what you see in the current movie. We were going to do just complete comedic non sequitur tags. You know, there were a couple of things that we edited together with Michael Pena and Paul, but when we really got to the end of the movie and we, you know, we end the main body of the movie with Michael Pena, we felt like we couldn't top that. That was really fun. So then when Captain America Civil War Daily started coming in, there was this scene and it was really just the raw dailies. And Kevin saw the dailies and he's like, come and take a look at this. And I watched the dailies and I'd seen some other stuff because I really wanted to see Paul in that movie to increase my level of envy. So it was interesting because we definitely set in motion in this movie a relationship with Sam, with Falcon, and he has a run-in with him in our movie, obviously, and then by the end of the movie, it becomes clear that he's looking for Scott. We're not sure why or what's going to happen, but it's a very, you know, it ends our movie. So this thing sort of took it to another level, and suddenly you see, you know, Sam and Cap and they're there with Bucky and his arms in a vice. What's going on? And something is going on. And it's suggested maybe we should call Tony. No, that won't work. And Mackie turns around and says, I know a guy. And then boom, it cuts to black and Ant-Man will return.
Yeah.
In true James Bond fashion comes up.
Yeah.
So it seemed like the completion of that arc and that relationship in our movie, but it also sort of starts your head spinning about, wait, what's in store for Scott in this movie? And that was something that, you know, again, the Russo shot for Civil War and we sort of repurposed it for our movie.
Okay. There is a line that Cap says. He says, and I've seen it twice and I couldn't quite make it out. He says, we can't call Tony because A, he won't believe us. And even if he did, the accords won't let him. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's presumably some superhero registration thing. Okay.
Yes.
That's what he says.
Yes.
That's good.
That's good to clear that up. And one of the things I also love about that tag, you know, because our movie's 185 and Civil War's and 240. And I like that. It's one of the things I love about the Marvel movies is that Anthony Mackie, clearly established in Winter Soldier, pretty serious-minded movie. And then he shows up in our movie doing light comedy with Paul Rudd playing the same character. And then at the end, in the tag, now we're back into the Russo's Civil War world. And I love that those characters can cross-pollinate like that and enter not only different movies, but different tones.
Yes. I have to ask, a little bit about the genesis of the movie. I mean, that's been poured over an awful lot.
Sure.
I believe there was a previous director on this film at one point.
I'd heard that, yeah.
I had heard that as well. Just in rough percentage-wise, how much of Edgar and Joe's draft remains in this film? Because obviously they have a credit
sure.
at the end.
Well, I'm not being evasive, but it becomes really hard to determine after a while because, you know, working on the script was such an ongoing endeavor. And we were constantly rewriting and refining as I was prepping the movie, as we were shooting the movie, and then even some in editing, you know, we were changing some stuff and did, I believe it was 3 days of additional photography. As I said, when I came on, Adam McKay and Paul Rudd had already been tasked with starting the rewrites. Percentage-wise, again, it's really hard to tell. I mean, the general heist structure of what Edgar and Joe created remains intact in our movie, as does the basic idea of Hank Pym being the mentor and Scott Lang being the pupil. And also this the third act, which, you know, moves toward this giant superhero battle that takes place in a little girl's bedroom
sure.
and on a train set, that remains pretty intact from Joe and Edgar's script. I mean, there are definite things that we changed. Obviously, we introduced the quantum realm,
yeah.
which in the comics is the microverse. That was never in the original drafts. Adam really, along with Paul, brought a lot of stuff, the structural stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, the run-in with the Falcon was never in the original drafts.
Yeah, yeah.
And the things that we did, you know, it was very important to me that this movie work as a standalone movie.
Sure.
Obviously, it fits into the larger universe, but I wanted it to work for someone who'd never seen any other Marvel movie or read a comic at all. That it had a beginning, middle, and an end. So the things that we added also, they definitely have, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, let's show him fighting the Falcon. It serves a plot purpose, and it is very much in line with their whole original heist structure.
Mm.
It's basically the trial by fire. It's like, okay, we've got the heist going, and we've got all the elements, but there's this one thing we need. It's a piece of technology, a signal decoy that Hank had designed in his S.H.I.E.L.D. days, and Scott, I'm going to send you in there to get it. We know you're not ready, but it's a trial by fire. And
sure,
of course.
Sure.
So that stuff, the tip montages with Michael Pena were something that we added. And that actually came post Adam McKay. That was when Paul and I were working with Andrew Bearer and Gabe Ferrari, who were our production writers.
Okay.
Who aren't credited on the movie. That's all, you know, Writers Guild stuff. But they did a lot of work on the movie. And I wanted to add these tip montages because Pena was proving to be so great in the movie. And that is one of those tropes in a heist movie where it's like, okay, if the guy decides, I'm in,
yeah,
but I
yeah.
got to know that tip is solid. And the idea of Luis going off on these tangents and basically being ADD and telling these rambling stories and then us being able to visualize them,
yeah.
which we do a couple of times in the movie. And
it's great. I love that.
So that was something we added.
Weirdly enough, I think that most people will look at that and think that was a holdover from Edgar and Joe.
Yeah.
It feels very...
Yeah, you may be right. I mean, you know, it really was my... wanting this movie to be as kinetic as possible
yeah.
and really move and feel and have the rhythms of a heist movie. It's similar to a lot of stuff transition-wise that I'd done in Bring It On and Down With Love and even actually weirdly in the TV movie stuff I'd done in the 90s. I directed a couple of Disney TV movies in like 1995 and 96 and
yeah.
they were very kinetic yeah. because, you know, they were essentially kids' movies, but they moved really... you know, kinetically like that. But you're probably right. That may be the case.
it's just one of those. It's one of those weird things. People might assume certain things about
yeah.
certain sequences and whatnot. But yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a certain population of people who will, for the rest of movie history, parse out what was this, what was that.
yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's interesting to me because it's probably a small percentage of people who do that. And I'm kind of one of them. I can't plead, you know... You know, I'm guilty of it as well on other movies. But at the same time, I just want the movie to stand on its own.
Sure.
I mean, there are plenty of movies in history, like, you know, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, Spartacus, where there were, you know, director switches.
Yeah, yeah.
The general population just wants to like the movie. 99.8% couldn't tell you who did what. But at some point, I could probably go into exactly what was changed and how and...
Mm.
And as I said, you know, when McKay came on, one of the first things we did was we sat with a friend of his who's a security expert, a genius guy, and we wanted to it was always in the script that Scott Lang was going to steal the suit from
yeah.
Hank Pym, but we wanted to come at it in a different way, and we added the whole fingerprint lock and how he sort of MacGyvers his way through Hank's kitchen and gets his way around that. And then also, in terms of breaking into the safe, the science of freezing the metal and stuff. That was all this guy who McKay brought in, and there was just enough reality and science in it that it worked. But we really wanted to build Scott as a guy who was resourceful and could, you know, he had a lot of experience as a cat burglar.
He is a cat burglar, but he also seems to have done just one major score, that altruistic Robin Hood-esque robbery. But there's little hints, I don't know whether that he has done other things as well.
Yeah, and the sort of backstory that we had talked about was that he had been a pretty successful cat burglar, then sort of fell in love and put that behind him and really got a respectable, steady job at VistaCorp. Yeah. And had a kid, and then when he saw what was going on behind the scenes at VistaCorp, he sort of decided to put his cat burglar skills to use to right this wrong. But then, by his own admission in the movie, he got carried away and went too far. And so, yes, there's this whole sort of life of crime that he had before that particular job.
And then it all leads to Baskin Robbins, and Baskin Robbins always finds out. Was that
we know that as a fact.
That's
yes.
an amazing line.
Don't screw with Baskin Robbins.
And Turkington as well. I love that that whole cameo. It's amazing.
Well, Greg Turkington again is someone that we have always been fans of, whether it's his Neil Hamburger alter ego or On Cinema at the Cinema, which is I don't know how to describe it. It's, you know, it's an online series that's in season five or six now.
Yeah.
And it's Tim Heidecker and Greg, and it's genius the way they're sort of like these supposed experts who know nothing and review movies, but it's really the sort of ongoing serialized story of their personal lives that's so brilliant.
Yeah.
But Turkington was someone who I was excited about, you know, having in the movie. And Kevin Feige and the guys at Marvel are real comedy connoisseurs. And so, you know, a lot of times you'll have to go to a studio and say, I want this guy, Greg Turkington. It's like, well, who's he? I don't know. We got to see other people. Kevin just got it immediately. Like, I love On Cinema. Let's get him. And that was it. And he was in the movie.
Heidecker is pissed.
Heidecker is furious.
Of course, you know. But I give Greg's cameo five buckets of popcorn. Five buckets of popcorn. Never buy my bags.
If you get a chance to watch the On Cinema Oscar special from last year, I showed up on the Oscar special as Peyton Reed, the director of Ant-Man. And Tim was very cocky about his directorial work on Decker, his other TV series, and we kind of got into it. It was it's fun to watch.
It's all good. I'm going to throw some quick things now for you to clear up. I mean, we talked a bit about the Falcon scene, which I love because it feels like it's something out of a comic book. You'd be reading, let's say, a Nightman comic book, then the Falcon turns up. They fight for 10 pages, then he goes away into his own into his own title.
Yeah,
I love that stuff. Why the Falcon? Was that did you have a list of the new Avengers you could have chosen, and did you choose Mackie, and how did that come about?
I have to give Adam McKay credit for that. Adam came in and pitched the idea of the scene, and then when it was talked about, well, who could it be? He's like, the Falcon, man. It's got to be the Falcon. And it had to be the Falcon in a way. It was the right level of character because I think it was too soon to put him up against Iron Man or Captain America or whatever. Mackie just seemed like, you know, he's so great in Winter Soldier, and I just wanted to see more of him. And it seemed to work. Mm. And also because of his powers. There seemed to be it awakened this childlike thing that we all had when you're reading comics. Oh, this hero has these powers. This one has the other powers. What would happen if they fought? He'll shrink, he'll fly around, but Falcon has the wings. It just seemed like it could work. And it made sense in the story, too.
Yeah. Did he yell, cut the check, after his first big hero entrance?
Well, it's not a matter of did he yell, cut the check. It was how many times after everything. Like, Mackie has this beautiful style of, like, you'll do a thing and I'll yell, cut. It's like, cut the check. And then it's like, you don't need any more. That's it. I mean, he's just amazing. I love Mackie.
Fantastic. When he first arrives, when Sam first arrives, he's talking to someone. I couldn't quite place the voice. Who's he talking to?
He's basically talking to someone back at the Avengers headquarters, just in terms of their security detail. There was much discussion about who he was going to be talking to, and we played around with a lot of other ideas, but it felt like anybody else. There was talk of, is it Scarlet? Who is it? And then it just, anything else would have sort of run away with the movie.
Absolutely. You'd be going, why aren't they fighting as well? Why aren't they coming out to...
You don't want to lead the audience down a path that, like, oh my God, now the Vision's going to show up and this is going to happen and whatever. It had to remain Ant-Man.
Moving on to the idea of of Hank and Darren and that idea of mentors and mentees, if you will. There's a really interesting line, two interesting lines actually. Hank talks about having worn the suit for years has taken its toll on him. And then there's a line that Hope has towards the end where she says that Darren, his exposure to the pin particles has effectively eroded his mind. Does that mean that Darren's been experimenting on himself, or have the particles leaked? And is that built into what Hank talks about, that he can't really don the suit one more time?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the idea that we liked. There were various versions of this in the comic book that were, they put timetables, these finite qualities on maybe how long, in the comics, how long Hank could shrink, or when he became Giant Man in the comics, how long he could stay large. And we liked the idea of putting some limitations on it. Particularly with Hank, we liked the idea of, you know, the movie has a question there of Hank has a problem, and there's a question that could be there potentially with the audience is, why don't you just put the suit on and take care of it? And we wanted to build in something that really, besides being, you know, up there in age, why he wasn't able to do it. And we really liked this idea of the suit had taken its toll on him, and that shrinking and growing a certain number of times, that comes with a cost. There might be a finite level. We don't define what how far that could be. And he also talks about that part of the function of the Ant-Man helmet is to protect you from exposure to the particles. In terms of Darren Cross, when we see him experimenting with the cross particle, you know, the second time he attempts to shrink this lamb, he's down there on the floor completely unprotected, and just, you know, whatever it takes, his ego is taken over. And that's really sort of what it is. And we also established that he might not have been altogether there to begin with.
That is a very, very good point indeed. And the Hank and Janet storyline is really interesting as well. That we actually get to see a version of Janet as a Wasp in 1987. Yes. Was that how late in the day was that? Was that something that was
well? Yeah. That was something that was really important to me. Again, I think in Edgar and Joe's original drafts, there might be one mention of Janet, but she was never a presence in the movie more than that. And I really, as someone who grew up with Janet Van Dyne and Hank Pym, I wanted her to be a presence in the movie. I wasn't sure how that was going to happen, but there was something McKay and Paul and I talked about, and the idea of sort of presenting this flashback, but really weaving it into the story in an organic way, that might have been at the root of this rift between Hope and Hank.
Yes.
That was something that we brought to the movie, and I feel like it works really well. I wanted to strengthen the emotionality of the movie.
Yeah.
In addition to being to providing all the action and the comedic stuff, I really like to be emotionally affected in a movie. And I felt like we had a really legitimate opportunity, because at the core of this movie, it's, you know, about two fathers and their daughters, and both of these men having these strained relationships. In Scott's case, he's been in prison. He just wants to be back in her life. But in Hank's case, when his wife passed away, he really did sort of hole up and became obsessed with the quantum realm and trying to bring her back at the expense of his relationship with his daughter. He really pushed her out of his life. And it's crucial and it's imperative for them to repair that relationship in order to pull off the heist. But the Janet thing really informs Hank's character and Hope's character equally. Their life is affected by this tragedy, and Pym sort of made it worse.
And was there ever talk about not showing the flashback to 87? Was that something that you discussed as well? I mean, it's great that we see it.
We talked about a lot of different versions of it. Like, what was the best and most effective way to make her a presence in the movie? I know that McKay wrote at least two different versions of whatever mission it was that they were going to be on. And we eventually landed on the missile. It had to be simple and effective, but it also had to be a little bit impressionistic, because it wasn't like we were switching to an action sequence. It's all through Pym's remembrance of it, and all informed. You know, his delivery during that is—it's very soft and emotional, and it's a big turning point for his character in that relationship. But we talked about a lot of different versions of how to do it. Do we open the movie with her? How much is enough, and how much is not enough? But it just becomes, you know, a crucial element of the story, particularly by the time we get to the end and Scott survived the quantum realm, and you see the first scene after in Pym's bedroom, Pym leaning in. You don't remember anything? Tell me. Like, this is a miracle that Scott's survived the quantum realm. And it's there's a potential that it's going to reignite this obsession of Pym's. And remains to be seen, again, if we're fortunate enough to be able to do another Ant-Man movie, you know, is that obsession a good thing, a bad thing? What's it going to lead to? But you know, that's exciting to think about.
Absolutely. In the credits, Hayley Lovett plays Janet.
Yes.
In that one flashback. Yes. But you've deliberately, when you see pictures of Janet with Hank, young Hank, you keep the face obscured. Is that to keep your options open just in case one day?
It's two things, really. You know, Hayley came in and did the motion capture stuff, and we shot both Michael and Hayley in front of this array, which is essentially five cameras positioned in front of them. They sit in the chair with dots on their face, and it's pure acting. It's just, you know, facial acting. And so Michael did all his stuff, and Hayley did Janet's. And I think the idea was, yes, to keep our options open, but also to keep that impressionistic thing of, we knew in its best version, it would be a very iconic image to see her fly and see the wings. And for those Marvel Comics fans, that it might actually be exhilarating. But we didn't want to get too into, you know, there were versions where there was dialogue between the two of them. And it just felt like it made it a little too present tense. It had to still be a little distanced and impressionistic.
I love the idea of the quantum realm and the going subatomic. You, in a way, you do what Ghostbusters doesn't do. Ghostbusters sets up the idea of crossing the streams, and then when they cross the streams, nothing happens. But in this case, you set up the subatomic. Don't go subatomic. Bad things will happen, and bad things do happen.
It's funny you mention that, because we actually talked about Ghostbusters and crossing the streams, and we also talked about Back to the Future and potentially creating a paradox, and you know, that sort of internal logic of the quantum realm. That was something that I really... McKay and I were in sync about, of it's gonna be a lot of shrinking in the movie. What if we got to a third act and took it even further? It was something we loved in the comics, and it embraced that psychedelic cosmic side of the Marvel universe, you know, and maybe even sort of gives a hint of what's in store of phase three for Marvel, you know, with Doctor Strange. But it was something also that tapped into this Richard Matheson thing, you know, Richard Matheson, who wrote Incredible Shrinking Man, both the book and the movie. He also wrote this Twilight Zone episode, Little Girl Lost, which really imprinted on me as a kid. And the basic idea of that, there's a little girl, and her bed is right next to a wall, and she falls into the wall. A porthole opens to another dimension, and the father, they have to figure out how to get her out. And they, my memory is, they put pennies on the wall because the wall's closing up, and he has to figure out. And it freaked me out as a kid, because I had a bed against a wall, and then I became paranoid that I was going to enter another dimension. I never did. In our movie, this is sort of the inverse, where the father is put in there, and I just love the whole existential thing of it. You know, we go through these different levels, and in prep, we actually met with this quantum physicist, and we're asking him all these questions, like he'd been to the quantum realm, but about like what in theory, what would it be like? Could your mind even comprehend it?
Yeah.
And we got into the notions of parallel universes and, you know, infinite possibilities, infinite present tense possibilities. And, it all led to this notion of, you know, the different levels of his journey. We knew we wanted to end with what we were calling the void, where it's darkness and there's nothing around the corner, and he may be stuck there for all eternity.
Which would have been an interesting way to end it.
Just end it.
I can imagine.
The sound goes out, he's floating. Hold on that for 5-6 minutes, and then just go to credits.
Well, it does go full 2001 towards the end.
Oh, yeah.
It's properly trippy at the end.
We wanted it to be, you know... We wanted it to feel like 2001 or Altered States or something like that, where it's this trippy, you know, trip that we take the audience on and that Scott experiences. And it's amazing if you get to experience it in Dolby Atmos. I mean, ILM did amazing work with the visuals. I love it. But the sound work that Skywalker did is terrific.
With Cassie's voice echoing
Cassie's
through the...
Cassie's voice and Pym's voice floating around and all the different the sounds and...
I thought when I first saw the film, I thought, aha, I think we might be about to meet Dr. Stephen Strange at this point. Were there discussions at any point about maybe doing that?
We had discussions, and a lot of those discussions ended with, let's not bite off too much in this movie.
Okay.
I mean, it really was, introducing the quantum realm alone was a great whole other tone and texture for the end of the movie, and it really existed as a story point in our movie. You know, there is something that can be glimpsed if you have a keen eye in the quantum realm sequence that Scott doesn't see, but it's there for the audience to see. If you want to go see the movie again and keep your eyes peeled, particularly when you buy the DVD and Blu-ray and have the capability of freeze framing.
Okay. Interesting.
There is definitely something in there for you to see.
Rough time code?
I'd love to give you an exact frame, but it's it can be seen in a Scott point of view, and it can also be seen in a shot right after that reflected in the lenses of his Ant-Man helmet.
Okay, right. Well, I'm going back now. You've sold another ticket. That's good. I want to talk about two maybe deaths in the film, one of which is the most affecting screen death of the year, Anthony.
Why, thank you.
He's gone. Is Anthony... A lot of people in the office are very concerned about Anthony. Is he dead? We said he's an ant.
Let's have a frank discussion about Anthony. One of the things that was a real challenge in the movie is creating all these ant characters, making them as realistic as possible, but also giving them these personalities.
Yeah.
We had to find that line because it couldn't turn into a Pixar movie in the middle of this movie. Yeah. I love Pixar movies, but that's not what we're doing here. And then it occurred to us, like, we like the idea that Scott Lang would have a different approach to being Ant-Man than Pym. Pym just numbers these ants,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
It's still science for him. But Scott forges this relationship, sort of a Lone Ranger Trigger relationship, or a Roy Rogers and... Wait, Roy Rogers has Trigger. Lone Ranger has Silver.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Let's not get those mixed up. But we like that idea that, could we do that? Could we convincingly forge this relationship and then have Anthony meet with a tragedy...
Yes,
and try and get some actual emotion from the audience. We love that idea, and I'm here to report that yes, Anthony does literally bite the bullet. Oh. But the bright side is that I believe, you check your science books, but I believe the average lifespan of a carpenter ant is 8 to 10 weeks in a cold climate, maybe 12 weeks. And I like to think that Anthony was close to his termination date anyway. And I can't think of a more fulfilled life for a carpenter ant than the one that Anthony led. So
he died doing what he loved.
Exactly.
And that's the main thing.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. And the other kind of death I wanted to talk about was Hank's. Because there was a semblance of a thought watching it that maybe he died at one point and you decided to go in a different direction after he gets shot by Cross. Was that ever something that you discussed?
Definitely while I was on the movie, we talked about it, but only briefly. It didn't make sense. It was only going to work if it propelled our movie in a way emotionally. And I didn't feel that it did.
Sure.
I liked the risk of him potentially dying, but I did not want to kill off Hank Pym.
He didn't
Hank
want
Pym's
be that
been
guy.
Enough. I mean, Hank Pym was, you know, let's face it. Hank Pym was denied the right to be one of the founding members of the Avengers in the Marvel Cinematic Universe,
sure,
which he was in the comics.
Yeah.
He finally gets his chance to make his screen appearance, and we have fun retroactively placing him in the history of, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. and with Howard Stark. It did not seem fair to kill off Hank Pym in the movie. I feel like there's still a lot of story to tell.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I suppose we could have done an Obi-Wan Kenobi and killed him off and have him...
back as an ant ghost.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be interesting. Can you talk about the decision to start the movie where you did in 1989 with that flashback with freaky young Michael Douglas? What the hell is going on there? That looks amazing. He looks younger than Hayley Atwell, which is exactly what you're going for.
Yeah, well, I mean, we figured out in the timeline that Pym in 89 would be roughly 45, 46, somewhere in there, and that Peggy... would be about 65. And that was one of the trickiest things for me because that effect terrified me. We've seen versions in the movie where they make actors seem younger and sometimes they don't work or you get into an uncanny valley situation where it's just like, oh, this is weird. But Lola, the company that did it, you know, had done the Skinny Steve stuff for the first Captain America, which I thought was hugely successful. But it scared the shit out of me because this was the opening scene of the movie. And if the effect didn't work, it potentially could turn off viewers early in the movie and they could check out. But we did, what we would do is we shot the scene with Michael Douglas with tracking dots on his face. And when I got a take that I loved, we had this younger guy, a guy named Dax, and he was a young guy that we cast, I believe, out of Georgia, who looked a lot like Michael Douglas of that era. He watched Fatal Attraction, Wall Street, Black Rain, all these old Michael Douglas movies, and really got his body language down really well. So I would shoot another take with him. Then we put Michael in a 3D scanner that Lola had and scanned his face. We gave all those materials to Lola, and they came back with this. And I'm so pleased with the final effect, but it made me so nervous.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. And that was always the opening, you know, always the idea to open in 1989 with Pine.
We had a lot of ideas. You know, in the original drafts, there was a standalone sequence. I think in Edgar and Joe's original drafts, it was Cuba in 62.
Oh, okay.
And the timeline didn't quite work for us anymore. But then it became Panama in 1989, that sequence. We shot that sequence.
Oh, really?
And okay. The sequence is terrific. But the more we got into editorial, that sequence just, it felt disconnected. It gave us something. It gave us Hank Pym in action as Ant-Man, but it didn't give us any real connectivity to present day. So then when McKay and Rudd and we were working on that S.H.I.E.L.D. sequence, that seemed to do it in the most succinct fashion. Mm-hmm. Let's see the moment mm-hmm. where he realizes he's been betrayed by S.H.I.E.L.D. and possibly by his old friend, Howard Stark. Let's see that moment that he decides, I'm locking this formula up and no one's ever going to get it.
Absolutely. And I know we've got to run here, but I just want to throw three very, very quick fire questions at
sure.
you very, very quickly. There's a lot of cool Easter eggs in the movie Milgram Hotel.
Yes.
Tales to Astonish is actually openly referenced. There's a Spider-Man reference towards the end.
There is. Yes.
Is that character that the lady says we've won? One who jumps, one who swings, one who crawls up walls. Are there three different characters, or are they all references to Spider-Man?
That remains to be seen. It might actually be some different characters.
Okay, interesting. Very interesting. The tank that
yes.
Hank has in his keyring. Do you have a backstory for how it got there?
That actually was one of the things in the original Cuba that became Panama. Mm-hmm. You see the moment where he shrinks down that tank.
Wow, okay.
And it was one of the things, too, it felt like too much of a giveaway.
Sure.
Because we saw it happen originally in that prologue, whereas now we just sort of see it's a keychain and, oh, he must have had some military pass or whatever, and hopefully there's a surprise element to it.
I feel sorry for the poor guys who are stuck inside that tank. They've been there for the last 30, 40
years. These tiny guys. They have to be fed and watered.
The Cure song, was that always the option to go for that one?
No, and in fact, that sort of came about from, there was always the briefcase fight, and we were looking for an iPhone joke.
Okay.
He was going to hit it, and there were all these jokes pitched, some of them funny, but it was basically, something like, you're going to wind up dead, searching for the closest Panera bread, something like that, which they were funny jokes, but they were just jokes. And then we landed on the idea of what if they activate the music, the iPod portion of it. I was and still am a huge Cure fan. And so we came up with the line about, I'm going to disintegrate you. Playing Disintegration by The Cure.
Amazing.
The opening track, Plain Song, is this epic Cure song. And when we put it against the picture, it's a fight taking place in a dark briefcase and there's zero G stuff going on. And suddenly there's this anthemic goth music playing. And it just lent this whole other tone to that scene that was sublime to me.
Amazing.
I loved it.
It's
and it comes, there's the helicopter fight, the briefcase, the backyard barbecue, and then we go to the bedroom. And it was important that each of those sequences have their own different distinct tones, and that really elevated that thing. That's one of my favorite moments in the movie.
And the absolute last thing before I'm dragged out of here
is
you choose not to shoot when Scott's in the Ant-Man suit. You choose not to shoot a sort of heads-up display or any close-ups of Paul within the mask or within the helmet. Was that to avoid direct comparisons with, say, Tony Stark and Iron Man?
I like that you pointed that out. It was something that we discussed a lot because in Iron Man, you go inside, you see Downey's full face and all the computer readouts. With Ant-Man, there were a couple of scenes that we shot Paul with the full helmet on, but we ended up shooting him with a helmet that covered his head but not his face. Because we wanted to see his eyes. Rudd has such beautiful eyes, but expressive eyes. And, we needed enough of that. So we would shoot it. And then we really adjusted sort of the level of red in the CG portion of the frontal mask because we wanted to get that emotionality out of him. And it was important that when Ant-Man is small running around, that he not feel disconnected from Paul Rudd. Mm. We've all seen movies where costume heroes, I love the actor. And then they put on the costume and
it's a stunt guy.
It's a stunt guy, or it doesn't move or sound or look like the character. So finding that right level for the eyes and the expressiveness was something we worked on a lot.
Fantastic. Peyton, could talk to you all day about this one. But
let's keep going.
I've got to let someone else in. Someone else has got to have a go. Thank you so much. A pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
It's great. Well, lovely man. And huge Ant-Man fan. I don't know if anyone knows.
So did you say Hugh Jackman fan?
That's what I thought you said.
Huge Ant-Man fan.
Oh, okay.
It may seem weird that I'm going to discuss Ant-Man on the Ant-Man podcast.
Yeah, I know. I just
so I don't know why.
Yeah, I think being random.
Well, we're all huge Jackman fans, aren't we?
I am.
Show me someone who doesn't like Hugh Jackman, and I will show you.
Do Gray Scott.
There we go. Yep.
Okay.
I just spilled water over the microphone. Thank you for that. Even Dougray Scott was like Hugh Jackman.
Even Dougray Scott in his heart of hearts must be going, aye.
He flings 25 darts into a picture of Hugh Jackman every morning and then says, you know what, I got to admit, he's a great guy.
Should we talk about the film?
Yeah.
Rather than Dougray Scott
or
Hugh Jackman. Okay. Where should we start? Where should we start? With Ant-Man and all things Antery and Manny, indeed.
Can I start at the beginning?
Yeah, are you okay? That's a weird place to start. Tarantino would never start there, but okay, go on.
I reviewed Terminator Genesis. I'm not being random. And I was so impressed at the de-aging of Arnie scene in that, right? Mm-hmm. I was really impressed by that. Mm-hmm. And then like, I saw Ant-Man. Mm-hmm. And it's like Michael Douglas has just walked in from Basic Instinct.
I actually said it makes the de-aging in Ant-Man makes the de-aging in Terminator Genesis look like the de-aging in Terminator Salvation. Because it is much... Yeah. It is incredible.
No, you're actually right. I mean, that's a weird way of saying it, but it's right.
Thank you. That's just how I talk.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, so the flashback is 1989, which is actually the year Michael Douglas made Black Rain and The War of the Roses. I looked it up. Okay. Didn't know that because I'm not a weird Michael Douglas stalker.
Yeah. In fact, he has his War of the Roses haircut in the opening scene of Ant-Man.
That must be what
because
they based it on.
Black Rain was, you know, a longer hair because he played Nick Rain in that, didn't he? I think. No, he didn't. Of course he didn't. But yeah, it's a preposterous film, Black Rain.
Have you ever seen it? Oh, yeah. Great decapitation scene.
Great decapitation scene.
Very racist.
And
is not as racist as Rising Sun.
Mm, that's true. That's true.
Which is astonishingly hilariously racist. Mm. But yeah. Anyway, we've gone off on a detour.
Yeah, but anyway, my point is, it's just like the look of Michael Douglas in that scene is absolutely astonishing. And but also, I love the fact that he's mixed in with Hayley Atwell, mm-hmm. who looks, you know, 20 years older than him.
Okay.
Then John Slattery, who just looks exactly as he
And
is.
He hasn't aged a day since Who's That Anyway, has he, really? I mean, it's...
Oh, I did it again. God, no, hang on. I got it right.
I was hilariously confusing John Slattery with Tony... Anyway.
I was saying to Chris just before this that it's kind of hilarious how John Slattery... Like, when does Dominic Cooper turn into John Slattery? Because Hayley Atwell plays that character all the way through. Mm. But miraculously, at some point in the 70s, I'm guessing, Dominic Cooper wakes up and he's John Slattery.
It must be when the hair changes colour.
Right.
Or when Dominic Cooper's unavailable. I'm guessing the two might be linked. It is a strange one, isn't it? Because, you know, there's at some point, someone at Marvel went, you know what? Hayley Atwell's going to play Peggy Carter at all stages of her life. So she's going to play her in her 30s, she's going to play her in the in, you know, Agent Carter, you know, in the 40s and the 50s, 1940s, 1950s, you know, she's going to play her in her late 90s in Captain America Winter Soldier. So we might as well have her in her 60s as well in
and it works
Ant-Man.
Great. Hmm. Works
it
great.
Does work great. But then someone also decided that no, we're going to cast two different Howard Starks. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It is weird. And there's no... And I'm not dissing either performer because they're both very, very good. And John Slattery in his one scene here. But there's no sense of a personality overlapping.
Not really.
Is there really?
Not really.
Like Dominic Cooper's Howard Stark is a bit of a louche. He's a bit of a player.
But no, Douglas looks amazing. That's kind of got me excited about could they do a whole movie. I think Douglas has been talking about this on the press rounds about he wants to see a movie where it's a younger Hank Pym teaming up with, you know, a young Robert Redford or whatever. I would watch the hell out of that.
It's like the film a few years ago that was mooted around Hollywood, you know, had people attached to it, where it was called Gemini Man. And it was about a young assassin who has a young clone that goes after him. And the idea was that technology would have caught up to the point where a young Harrison Ford could go after a new Harrison Ford. Actually, we're at that point now.
Which is essentially what Terminator Genesis should have been. The whole movie should have been old Arnie versus young Arnie, which was actually what Cameron wanted to do for Terminator 2. That was his first idea for it. But the technology wasn't there to do it now.
Yeah,
it is now.
That's a great idea. Just briefly, before we talk further about this scene and starting the film in 1989 with some S.H.I.E.L.D. business, talking of Dougray Scott being angry about Hugh Jackman, Gerard Sanders plays Howard Stark in Iron Man. You see him in a newspaper obituary. When Howard Stark is killed, you see in flashback Tony Stark's life.
Oh, right.
And Gerard Sanders is the first Howard Stark. And he must be sitting there going, man, come on. Surely I could have done something. Oh, he must be throwing 25 darts at John Slattery's face.
Yes.
Oh, well.
It's like whoever played John Connor in that sort of, you don't really see him in the first ever Terminator. The adult John Connor.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Whoever that was. Anyway.
Anyway, shall we move on to discussing the idea that the film opens in 1989 and it with Hank Pym as a member of S.H.I.E.L.D., signing from S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, handing out his resignation to Peggy Carter and Martin Donovan's evil Mitchell
Ooh.
Carson.
Ooh.
And
who's a character from the comic books.
He is a character from the comic books.
Who originally almost is Ant-Man himself. He's an army guy who's a S.H.I.E.L.D. guy, sorry, who's meant to get the Ant-Man suit, and he has it stolen off him by Eric O'Grady, who is the sleazeball Ant-Man incarnation. And he's kind of the villain in that, so it's a little nod to that.
And in fact, they have a nod that Martin Donovan may return as Mitchell Carson in future installments when he picks up the Pym particles at the end. Or not the Pym particles, more the cross.
The serum, the shrinking serum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he picks up Darren Cross's liquid at the end, and he's going to cover himself in Darren Cross's liquid and see what happens. So, yeah, let's talk about that later on. So 1989, do you think that's an interesting place to start?
I liked the scene. I thought the Douglas cameo was very effective, the effects and everything. I do wonder if it takes away some of the mystery and takes away some of the Scott going on a journey with Scott and finding things out as he does, because it basically tells you everything in the first scene, and then you're waiting 25 minutes for Scott Lang to figure out what the suit is and everything. So
yeah,
I kind of wonder if, you know, it would have been more effective if the first time he shrinks, it's kind of a surprise to us as well, rather than...
Yeah. Although you're going to see a film called Ant-Man.
No, I know. you were expecting it, yeah. I know, but it kind of felt a little bit detached from it. It felt like it was telling too much.
Yeah, I wonder if keeping Hank Pym off the screen for the first 10, 20 minutes would have been a way to go, maybe. Who knows? But, you know, it's fine. Everything, you know, obviously, everything's all connected, and we're going to talk a bit more about how this film ties into the MCU later on. But, yeah, it's fine. The only thing about that opening scene was it felt very TV showish to me. And, you know, the idea that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is an epic, huge, humongously budgeted TV show that's just ongoing, and this is episode 11. That really did feel like a cold opening to me.
Yeah.
And then you were going to go into the credits starring Paul Rudd, also starring Michael Douglas, like Streets of San Francisco, which would have been amazing. But that did feel a little, and, you know, pardon the expression here, but it did feel a little small for me, that beginning. I don't know if they would have started off with the...
So they should have had a bigger table.
A much bigger table. But, you know, hey, it always established, you know, Hank, you know, he lost his wife. It established that he has a hair trigger temper, which is useful. Comes into play later on when he tries to punch... When he punches Darren Cross. Nice little seeds are so in there. Should we talk about... The movie then introduces us to Scott Lang, to Paul Rudd, who, of course, as most of the actors were... was cast by Edgar Wright, and then he co-wrote the screenplay after Edgar and Joe left the project. Edgar and Joe Cornish, of course, co-wrote it with Adam McKay, and there were a couple of on-set writers as well who don't get credited, as Peyton Reed said, but he was indicating that they should have done. But so, what do we think of Scott Lang? Very interesting introduction, being punched in a prison.
Yeah, I liked that. That gag was very good, where he's getting duffed up, and it turns out to be their kind of goodbye ritual. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's good, Rudd, isn't he? I mean, he's just great.
Yeah.
He's great in everything.
Yeah.
Think of a name of bad Paul Rudd performance. Do it now. You can't.
I can't.
See, you can't.
I can't. Except maybe that, was that film he was the bad guy in, the action movie years ago? That dreadful sci-fi cop thing he did in the 90s or the 2000s or something like that.
Oh, yeah, Gen Y Cops or something.
Gen Y Cops, that's it, where he's bleach blonde, and there's a highlights reel of Paul Rudd on YouTube. In that movie.
That sounds amazing.
It's not his... Yeah, he's still amazing in it. Yeah. Who am I kidding? He's great, and he brings a slightly different flavor. He brings... You know, when he was first cast, I thought he would be ruddy good, but he brings this slightly everyman-ish quality. Like, he's not as wisecracking as Chris Pratt is. He's not as droll as Tony Stark is. There's something more grounded about him.
He's more world-weary. He's more tired. He's a bit sort of beaten up. He sort of has this sort of rumpled look to him, Paul Rudd, which and obviously Judd Apatow uses to good effect.
And aside from old Hawkeye, he's the first proper Marvel hero to have a daughter and a wife and have a kind of van. And this is kind of a movie about two dads and two daughters, which is something different.
Yeah.
Which gives it an interesting dynamic, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like they've maybe taken the edge off him. He's more of a kind of small-time crook in the comics. And in this, they kind of bend over backwards to explain that he's actually a great guy.
Yeah. He doesn't like violence. That's a key thing. He keeps saying, I don't like violence.
Does he not like violence, but the robbery he did was even, you know, to give all the money from evil people to good people. He doesn't keep any of the money himself.
Yeah.
Which he did in his earlier robberies, right?
Presumably. I guess so. But I mean, they set him up as being a great guy from the beginning, and I wonder if it might have had more of a journey had he been a bit of a scuzzball, a bit more of one.
Yeah.
I can kind of see why they didn't go in that direction, but...
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because Chris Pratt in Star-Lord in Guardians of the Galaxy has that... And maybe they wanted to change it because of that, has relatively the same arc, where he is a rogue and a scoundrel, and at the beginning of the movie he's doing something illicit and he's ripping people off left, right and centre, and then by the end of the movie he's legitimately trying to save the galaxy. Maybe they wanted to go in a slightly different direction, so it's not quite the same arc for Scott Lang. So he's a bit more altruistic right from the off. I'm gonna call into question, Dan, your description of Paul Rudd as rumpled. I don't think he's
rumpled.
He's not rumpled. The man is chiseled. Look at him. Look at a picture of him now.
No. He's like a fine cotton shirt that just hasn't been ironed.
I don't agree with that at all. He has a face that's been carved out of alabaster. It's amazing.
I think his grooming ritual is fairly extraordinary.
He's got a just climbed out of bed kind of look to him.
No, he's got smooth skin that's been woven by spiders.
We need to move on. I mean, I did like the way that the movie portrayed him as being very smart. The way they did it, you didn't just hear he is smart. You actually saw him doing it, and I really liked the way he got into that safe.
Yes, absolutely.
Safes.
Yeah, where he Heisenbergs his way in, doesn't he? He uses science. Yay, science! I really like that as well. He says, "I have a master's in electrical engineering." I think is what he says.
Yes.
And then for once, he actually steps up the plate.
And you've got a great Titanic gag.
Yes,
off the back of it.
Absolutely.
From his buddies, his underworld buddies, who are represented by ethnic minorities, which is slightly dodgy, but they are hilarious, especially Michael Peña, who I think stole this movie.
Yeah.
Anthony the Ant and Michael Peña stole this movie.
Oh, should we talk about Anthony the Ant later on? Because I'm not sure I'm ready to talk about Anthony.
It's pretty emotional.
It is pretty emotional.
It wasn't even a real ant. It was CGI.
It doesn't help, Dan.
Computer-generated insect.
Yeah.
Because I believed he was real. I believed he was real. Yeah, I love... Quick note about how funny the film is.
Yeah,
because we watched it. I think Dan, did you watch it with us the first time? I can't remember.
Yeah.
In a small screen room with some journalists, and you know we've said this in the podcast before that a lot of the journalists can be stuffed shirts, and you know it's fine if the film plays well, but then I saw it a second time with a massive audience.
Everyone left before the stings, didn't they? That was what I remember from that screening.
Yeah.
It's like a Marvel film and it finishes and everyone left apart from you and I.
I know.
We were sitting there going, guys,
how do you not know to stay around for a Marvel movie?
Fools.
Perhaps they just didn't care.
They might not well have not cared.
But yeah, it's a very funny film, and I think those three guys steal it. Michael Peña is fantastic, and I love, and again, this is one of the things I love about Marvel movies. They nail the ending almost every single time. I think they do, you know, whether it's you know, I had a date at the end of Captain America: The First Avenger, or I love the ending of Age of Ultron with Cap just about to say Avengers Assemble, and then it cuts off. And I love the ending, whether it's Tony Stark saying I am Iron Man at the end of Iron Man. And I love this. I love that it ends on a supporting character, not the main hero, but a supporting character having told some incomprehensible story, and then blinking, just enthusiastically blinking at the camera. Or not the camera, but Paul Rudd, and then cut. I really love that. I think they nail their endings.
We'll get to the stings later, right? Yeah, just on the it being a very funny movie note, I was delighted to see Greg Turkington. Dan, do you know who Greg Turkington is?
I do not know who Greg Turkington is.
He's a kind of a cult. He is basically Tim Heidecker and Greg Turkington do a spoof movie review show where it's kind of, I guess it's a spoof of Ebert and Gene Siskel.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's called On Cinema at the Cinema, and it's a web thing. I encourage people to go watch it. It's very kind of dry and ironic in the Tim and Eric sense. But Peyton Reed is a huge fan of that as well.
Yeah.
And so I was delighted to hear he was putting him in the movie. And he plays the manager of the Baskin Robbins.
I was going to say, is that who the manager of the Baskin Robbins store is?
I thought he was brilliant. And I thought the whole, the Baskin Robbins, what's the line?
Baskin Robbins always finds out.
Baskin Robbins always finds out, bro.
Yep.
That was awesome.
That was a very funny line. He's great. Turkington's fantastic. I discussed it a little bit with Peyton Reed on the interview you've just heard. Yeah, he's so funny. What I love about him as well is that if you watch On Cinema at the Cinema, Turkington usually has his arms folded. And when we first see him in the movie, He has his arms folded, and he sits there in the classic Turkington
clothes.
Classic Turkington. Five bags of popcorn for Greg Turkington in this movie. But it is a very funny film, and so T.I. is very funny as Dave. He has that great line when they're in the van, and Bobby Cannavale and Wood Harris. Avon Barksdale, by the way, just shout out to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which now has Avon and Stringer in it as well.
I wonder if those characters will ever meet.
That would be amazing if they did.
And they have a really meaningful conversation whilst looking across at a city at night time, and we'll know what's going to happen, and you just can't stop it. It's like destiny. Sorry. Where was I?
They'll have cosmic burners.
Yeah.
There's that great joke in the van when they're banging on the van, and Bobby kind of finally opens the van, and T.I. goes, you're not going to believe this, but a black guy who looks exactly like me bundled us up and put us in the back of the van and drove off. That's really funny. And then David Dasmalkian as Kurt has one of the lines of the film. I think the line of the film is probably Baskin Robbins always finds out, bro. But it is the work of the gypsies is also a fantastic line. I just want to point out in the casting quirks of, you know, every movie is a superhero film these days. David Dasmalkian is also one of the few people who straddles both the DC movies and the Marvel movies, because of course he is, Dan.
He is in the Joker. Dark Knight. He is not the Joker. He is one of the Joker's goons
who gets
interrogated by Harvey Dent.
Yes, yes. I don't know why I said Joker. You said Dark Knight, and I just instinctively went Joker.
Yes,
he's the Joker.
That was Heath Ledger, who was a fantastic Australian-born actor who put in a brilliant performance that he won an Oscar for after he sadly died.
Great. Yes. Oh, no. Okay. I said great before that bit. Anyway, yes. He is usually terrifying in things. I find him quite sort of not upsetting to look at, but he has a kind of. I'm being unfair to him, but I mean it's a compliment because he's a great actor. But he is usually fairly intense and stuff. So it was
like
nice
you,
to see him.
Nick, in many ways.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dan. You're talking of funny business. My joke of the movie is probably the Cure, Siri joke when. Was it Yellow Jacket says disintegration or disintegrate?
That's funny. But
the song, by the way, just want to say the song is not disintegration.
What's the song, Dan?
It plays the album Disintegration, and the song is Plain Song, which is the first track on the album, which is a fantastic tune.
And that would have been even better if they'd been falling out of a plane instead of a helicopter.
No, but Plain, P-L-A-I-N, Song.
Plain Song.
Yeah.
So I don't know my Cure.
Okay.
All I know is that it's Friday, I'm in love. That's all I know. And it is Friday, and I am in love. Oh, so this is great. It's all good. We're all happy for each other. But my problem with that, and it really took me out of the movie, is that they didn't say, Siri, I'm going to disintegrate you, because otherwise Siri wouldn't play that.
So Yellow Jacket should have had a henchman called Siri, but that's, you would have written that all the way into the movie.
Or that could have been Scott Lang's nickname.
Siri Lang.
Also on the soundtrack, Adam and the Ants.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
where?
I don't know. I got that from the end. I'm not an Adam. Are you an Adam and the Ants guy?
Not really. No. I was actually quite surprised to see it come at the end because I didn't go, oh, they're playing Adam and the Ants at any point. So I missed it. Sorry.
Okay. What was your favorite joke, Dan, of the movie?
Nick just said it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So
what was your second favorite joke?
Yeah. What was your second favorite, Dan? Come on.
All right. Okay. I'll do one which actually isn't one of my favourite jokes, but it'll bring it into the conversation. So ask again.
What was your favourite joke, Dan?
Well, I really like that that action beat when they're fighting and he just picks up the ping pong bat and thwops.
Yes.
And thwops Yellow Jacket into the thing. And he's going,
yes.
And it's just a really good visual gag.
It's fantastic. And it's the sound, isn't it? The boop.
Yeah.
It just absolutely sells it. That got the biggest laugh, I think. At the major screening I was at, the big multimedia screen I was at.
I think my favourite joke got a slightly bigger laugh. Really? I wasn't at your screening, but...
Well, true. This is true. So the Cure joke got a slightly bigger laugh.
That's why the
ping pong definitely got the biggest laugh.
No, that definitely got the biggest laugh.
We'll settle this later.
It was on the laughometer, it was easily 7.9, whereas I think this integration was more of a 6.4.
Okay. Well, we'll figure this out later.
So, it's a very funny film. We've all established that, but... We should talk about the emotion of the movie now, and not just the fact it's a father and daughter story, and a father and daughter story, and two father and daughter stories. But let's talk about the biggest loss I think in the Marvel Cinematic Universe to date. Ant-247, Anthony, R.I.P. Anthony. He's gone.
I've gone weepy,
and he ain't ever coming back. He ain't ever coming back. It's so you guys can talk about it because I'm a bit joked up.
But we know that characters have died in the Marvel universe before and come back. So I'm just confident that Antony will return.
It's an ant that's been hit by a bullet. I'm not entirely sure.
Which, I'll tell you what, that was a bloody good shot.
He's firing blind at that point. It's mainly the one shot. He would never be able to do that again.
I think it will be revealed that he was using a special quantum bullet and that Antony is now in the quantum realm, just ruining quantum picnics, and he will be back. If I believe anything, it's that Antony the ant will return.
Isn't it the female ants who have wings? Yeah, I'm not an expert. I thought the winged ants were like the ones that wanted to be new queens. That's why they fly off to go and find new colonies. I could be completely wrong here, but I think Antony might be female.
Well, even if he were, then Scott Lang doesn't necessarily know that.
No, I know.
It's not like he has like an ant package that you can lift up the undercarriage and see. I mean, Scott Lang is attached to Antony, and Antony's loss is a tragic one, and one that I think the film struggles to recover from. No, it's fascinating and fun that they picked out one ant in particular for him to bond with, and he even has to feed him that little droplet of water, and they really become pally, don't they? And then Antony gets shot dead. And I mentioned this to Peyton Reed as well, but I genuinely thought they were going to kill Hank Pym as well at the end when he gets... when he gets shot by Darren Cross.
It was interesting because I think it was last summer when they were still shooting that somebody somebody working on the film tweeted a photo of Michael Douglas with his stunt double. And his stunt double, or just stand-in or whatever, they both had a red blood patch over their heart, where the character had been shot.
Yes.
So they gave it away that he was going down.
Hmm.
And so I kind of thought, this is a gigantic spoiler. Well, it still is a spoiler, but...
I forgot about that.
So, that was a bit sloppy.
It's a weird one because, I've complained in the past about how Marvel don't have the cojones to properly kill people off. They always kind of, dial back. Mm-hmm. And yet I actually found myself when Hank Pym got shot, actually finding myself thinking, I don't really want this character to die. I like the fact that he would still be around in future Marvel films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's this continuation of that character. So I kind of contradicted myself there a bit. I think, honestly, I'm sorry to upset you, I didn't give a crap about Antony. Couldn't care less. Whatever, it's an ant.
I bet you stand an ant, don't you, Dan? But you just crush them.
No.
Does an ant have a quarrel with a boot?
No. It's a good line. But no.
It would be amazing if Antony the Ant does come back and gets into a fight with Loki and defeats his boot. And that would be an amazing callback. But let's go back to Hank Pym because I have a couple of interesting facts.
I said at the beginning.
Let's have a Pym workout.
I said at the beginning that Nick, who was on set, would have some interesting facts, and I wasn't sure he could deliver on that.
Well, this first fact is really, really not interesting in the least. It's actually the most boring fact I think I've ever learned.
But brilliant.
I went to Hank Pym's... I was in his bedroom.
Really?
That's not creepy, because he wasn't...
Well, did you watch him sleep?
I didn't watch him sleep. I went to Atlanta, to Pinewood Studios there, and essentially they had the entire Pym mansion, including the Pymnasium, as Paul Rudd phrased it, where he gets his... training montage.
Mm-hmm.
And they had his lab where they had real ants scurrying around.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had his bedroom, which I don't believe actually appears in the film, does it?
No, I don't believe it does.
This is my first...
Well, hang on, yes, he does.
Scott does sleep in it.
Okay, but this is my first fact.
Yeah.
Hank Pym's bedside reading is a book. It's a real book. It's called The Elegant Universe, Super Strings, Hidden Dimensions, and the Quest for the Ultimate Theory.
I was wondering what that book was.
Well, of course that's going to be on his thing, because he wants to find his wife.
Is the next book Jack
it's a real
Reacher.
Book. So if you want the extended experience, that you can go and buy that. I don't recommend it. I had a flick through it. It looked really dull.
Mm-hmm.
My second fact is that Hank Pym's outfit and look is based on Tom Wolfe, writer.
Okay.
My third fact is a question. This is my final one.
Okay.
In which previous Marvel film does Hank Pym get referenced?
Ooh.
There's only one of them.
Ooh. Is it one of the X-Men films?
It's not.
Okay.
It's not Christian.
It's a Marvel Cinematic Universe film,
isn't it? Marvel Cinematic Universe, and Kevin Feige confirmed he's not mentioned by name. But Dr. Selvig says I'm going to email him.
He has a friend at S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes, and I'm going to email him. And that is Hank Pym that he's talking about.
That's Hank Pym he's talking about.
But Hank Pym's left S.H.I.E.L.D. by that point.
He says he has an expert. He knows an expert. I always presumed that was Banner.
No, because he mentions Banner separately to that.
Right.
But yeah, it is four. And I thought that was interesting because I had a wander around Hank Pym's house and he doesn't have a computer. So is he going to internet cafes to check his email?
No, he's got the downstairs lair, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And by the way, I know a few people have had a problem with why Scott takes the suit and puts the suit on. Putting the suit on is a bit more of a leap, but taking the suit, I think, is actually fine because he's figuring, I've gone through two safes to get here, and this is the only thing in this room. Ergo, vis-a-vis, concordantly, it must be worth stealing.
I get that. I thought it was a bit odd that he tries it on in a bathroom.
Well, he's a fetishist.
I would.
Well, you're normally wearing sort of quite skin-tight leather ensemble outfits, Dan, so that doesn't shock me.
But, exactly.
The biggest thing, of course, is that he's coincidentally the same size as Hank Pym. Imagine if he wasn't.
Yeah.
No film.
Endgame. Wow, this is a chilling alternate universe that you're presenting here.
Maybe though. But, no, but the thing is, right? Maybe
that's why he
chooses
him.
Work with me here. The Pym particles operate in such a way that whoever wears the Ant-Man suit.
No.
It changes size to perfectly fit their body because it's a suit that grows and shrinks.
Or Hank Pym has really done his homework and he has found the perfect guy who is the same size as him. I didn't quite buy that Hank Pym was, you know, that kind of that genius that he could spread word through the criminal underworld and find.
So hang on. So you can feel for an ant that's shot and yet you can't accept
that comes from the heart, Dan. Comes from the heart, something you do not have.
Yeah, you can't explain how you feel. It's just something that happens. No, I love that. I love the I know what you mean. It's a bit hard to buy that he's been slowly manipulating Scott into this position. Although it does make for two of the
funny, hilarious. The two of them, aren't there? Those kind of montages.
Well, this one that ends the film, which is great, and that includes the now de rigueur Stan Lee cameo. Which is very fun, but I kind of like the idea though of.
Do you think we'll ever get a Marvel film where all the Stan Lees bump into each other? Because this is a universe where there are like now 25 of this guy,
something like that. Well,
what's going on? If you are they going to ever explain why there's so many of him?
Yeah. He's Madrox, the multiple man.
Madrox.
Yes, that one.
Him. Yeah, multiple Stan Lees, multiple universes. Okay. And like Time Cop, they all meet. But I love the idea of Hank Pym googling cat burglar, altruistic, about 5'10". And then getting like a list of people
at his internet cafe where he's checking is getting his emails from Dr. Selvig.
No, I think you'll find he doesn't use the internet, he uses the internet.
Okay.
All right.
That's great.
Okay.
That's really good.
That is good.
Should we talk about some other things? Let's talk about the idea that it's a father daughter story, as Nick mentioned, and the relationship between Michael Douglas and Evangeline Lilly as Hope Van Dyne, daughter of Janet Van Dyne, who is, of course, as the film reveals, the Wasp. And the relationship in the comics over the years between Hank and Janet is interesting and fractured and a bit tortured and
very dark.
Yeah, and
very
it can get very dark. And it's interesting that they decided not to go with Janet, that she's dead or quantumed or she's off with Sam Beckett or doing whatever it is that she's doing at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, I mean, to expand on that, Hank in some of the comics is almost psychotic, I'd say. He's alcoholic, he's a wife beater.
Well, he creates Ultron. In the comics, he's a genius, and the Ant-Man was one of the founding members of the Avengers, so he's a big noise in terms of Marvel history, and he's a genius, and he created Ultron, and he didn't take that well. So, as well as becoming Ant-Man, and then later on Giant-Man, and he was Yellowjacket as well at one point. He creates Ultron. Ultron goes nuts, and that's always something that's haunted him. So,
but I mean, it goes to some really dark places. I was reading the big omnibus, which has just come out, I think, of lots of classic, and they have at the end a kind of biography of him, which is just incredibly dark. You go, wow, this is really weird, twisted stuff. And yeah, he's a very dark character at points. Not in all of it, but definitely goes there. So I think when they talked about making this movie in the first place, a lot of fans were going, are you going to go there? They can't go there, can they? Well, it's the same with Iron Man, where there are the alcoholism stuff they haven't really got into, but even
will
with Hank Pym, I think.
Yeah, interesting. But the relationship between Hope and Hank, I think, is more important to the film than the relationship between Scott and his daughter, Cassie.
Yeah, definitely. Although I have to confess, I didn't really buy the whole why doesn't she just be Ant-Man thing, you know? They made sure they addressed it, but no, it's because it's really obvious question that hangs over it. You know, why bother
He's already lost his wife. Why would he put his daughter in harm's way? I, I,
Of course, he is putting his daughter in harm's way by putting her.
Yeah, she's already.
But to a lesser extent, a far lesser extent, I think he's already lost his wife by having her wear one of these outfits. So, you know, to put his daughter in the outfit, although they reveal, don't they, that the suit is there.
Yeah.
So he must have considered it.
Yeah.
Didn't want to do it.
Yeah, would that have been the suit that she wore, or would she have got to wear the Ant-Man costume as well?
Because the pin particles would have meant that it would have reformed to fit her body.
Or hang on, was that outfit just one of the Wasp's extra suits?
As you say, they were working on it for her mother. They weren't working on it for her. So it was definitely set up for her. But I absolutely get that. And of course, the script also does mention as well that she came to him, that they were estranged. There's a genuine estrangement there. Where she hasn't given him the time of day for 20 years or whatever it is, until she sees that Darren Cross is beginning to go down this path and is a bad idea. So she goes to her dad. So from that point on, I can get that. I can get why. And Dan, this is interesting as a father that you're saying this, because Nick and I are not parents. We're not Nick, are we?
I don't believe so.
No, we're not. But I could see that he wouldn't want to put his daughter in the same situation.
Yeah, but when my kids are adults, they can, you know, that's them. Whatever's their choice is their choice.
Yeah, but what if they want to do something that is still in your control?
Hang on, right, okay. I'm really trying to make a mental leap here to trying to imagine.
You imagine your son as one
of my children.
We might be
becoming a superhero.
We might be getting into strange territory here. But I like that. I like that aspect of it. I thought first time around, I thought that Evangeline Lilly's performance was a bit too cold and standoffish. But second time around, it worked a lot more for me, especially once you know that there is that underlying emotion there that, you know, she's working with her father Hank. But she doesn't necessarily want to work with him in close proximity as well. I will say, coming from moratorium in movies on sons and daughters who are estranged from their parents, calling him by their first name and not dad. And then we always know that by the third act, they will call him dad, which is what happens here. Anyway, small point, quibble, move on.
Well, you know, the whole you know, estranged fathers thing is just in virtually every Hollywood movie ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's father sons, father's daughters. That seems to be the food of drama at the moment.
I liked Evangeline Lilly. I thought she was great. You know, I think there was stuff that they filmed. When I was on set, I got to watch. They were in the gym, and there was some really funny stuff they were shooting. They were just improvising away. And in the movie, it's like 3 seconds of screen time. So I think they shot a lot and they just couldn't get it in. But she does do some funny stuff.
Okay,
which maybe we'll see some deleted scenes.
Yeah.
But they were both doing, Paul Rudd was doing an extraordinary thing where he was putting his leg across on the mat to make a farting noise, which is something he said he perfected on A Lovey Man. He was sitting in a leather chair, but he was just doing this extraordinary long. I hope that's on the DVD.
Amazing. Amazing. I know, I like her. Like I say, especially second time around, it really clicked for me.
Hmm. I thought she was really good. I actually wanted to see more of her in the film. You know, I wanted her to do more.
And she was rocking a Spalco, which is what I call that hairstyle, after Irina Spalco.
Okay.
That hairstyle is the best thing about Crystal Skull.
I call it the Mia Wallace.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the Spalco is a little bit more
severe. Or the Louise Brooks.
Yeah, I was going to say the Louise Brooks.
Spalco is more fun to say than either of those words. So.
But she's a character from what film?
It was a fan fiction movie, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, I think. It was. You can find it on the internet.
I'll Google it later on.
Yep. Yes, it's the fourth film in the Indiana Jones trilogy.
I didn't even know they made a fourth one, Dan, to be honest. That's very interesting. Good news to me. That's talk. So that's talk about... Did that work for you, Nick, the emotion of the film? Because she said, didn't she, to you in your Empire feature, that the movie became more American and more emotional as it went along.
Mm. Yeah, it was still funny. Generally it did. I don't know if we needed to see that flashback scene with the Wasp necessarily. I mean, should we talk about the tie-ins with the Marvel stuff?
Yeah, definitely. It was interesting. And Peyton Reed says that there were several versions of that as well, that there was a voiceover-only scene and there were different iterations of that at one point before they decided to go the way they did. The idea of, I think it's there to set up, and again, as I said to Peyton Reed, this movie, you know, Ghostbusters goes out of its way to go, don't cross the streams, bad things will happen, and then he crosses the streams and nothing happens. Whereas in this one, it's like, don't
don't touch the regulator because bad things will happen, and then bad things do happen, and it's only that he gets out of it by the skin of his teeth and by sheer luck.
So he goes very 2001 Space Odyssey.
It does, doesn't it?
I thought Paul Rudd was going to turn into the Star Child, which would have been hard to buy.
It didn't make any scientific sense, though.
Right.
If he goes subatomic, why does he still have form?
Right.
Because I get that he would still have a physical form if he shrinks while he's still in the, you know, physical realm as we know it. But once he's gone subatomic, and how is he even perceiving sound waves?
Dan, it sounds like you've been reading The Elegant Universe, Super Strings, Hidden Dimension, and The Quest for the Ultimate Theory.
You know, it's like nice, yeah, nice effects, good in 3D,
We don't know what would happen if you went at the quantum realm, or the microverse, as they can't call it.
Why not? I actually thought we were going to get to see the Micronauts.
Yeah.
You know, who are the Micronauts, Dan?
The Micronauts, it's part of the Marvel world where the idea is if you shrink down enough, you go into the subatomic realm, and there's actually a microverse, as Chris just said, there. And it's a whole other universe, except it's happening on a sub-microscopic scale.
Do they have micro machines?
No, they're kind of like, I think, as I remember, they have spaceships and like giant insect things.
Sounds
and
amazing.
Stuff like that.
That's
and
incredible.
Yeah, I can't even remember the character names, but I had these really cool Micronauts toys, which were like, they were like figures held together by bits of like magnet. If anyone listening has still got any of these toys, send me a photo. I want to see one again.
Or the toys.
And they had like little magnetic balls, and you click together and you could change the body parts. So you can mix up the good guy's body parts with the bad guy's parts.
Mm. Okay.
And they had centaur bits as well. Like you could stick the top end of the body onto like legs or onto a horse's body. And I really want to see the Micronauts in the Marvel Universe, please.
I wasn't allowed toys. No, I was.
Wow. I was going to say that took a dark turn.
I had lots of G.I. Joes, but we'll get into that in
the G.I. Joe
for the next G.I. Joe
spoiler
movie.
Podcast.
But yeah, you can see, so in the quantum realm, there is a little cameo. There's a little Easter egg.
I asked Peyton Reed about this, as hopefully you've just heard as well. And he said, because I'd missed it, and he said there is something there, and I haven't seen the film since we interviewed him. But Helen O'Hara, who is not here today because she's in America, she says she thinks it's a silhouette of the Wasp. Because I thought it might be Doctor Strange. I thought, honestly, when the movie went full 2001, which I totally wasn't expecting, and I could have actually gone on for another 1 or 2 minutes of that.
Why would it be Doctor Strange though? He's mystical and magic, and
mystical and magical, but he has influence across many realms and many dimensions. And Kevin Feige has already spoken about Doctor Strange being the key to opening up different dimensions and different realms and alternate universes and all that sort of stuff, all that sort of cool stuff. And I genuinely thought that the minute we started going to that world, and it goes really trippy, and I could have taken an extra couple of minutes of that.
Yeah.
I thought he's going to be saved by Dr. Stephen Strange. That somehow Strange is going to be in this realm, and he's you may make that face, but that's what I thought.
I'm glad that didn't happen.
I'm also glad that
it didn't happen.
Because it felt like there was enough, possibly a little bit too much of the
pushing
other series along. The Falcon scene, I got to say, when the new Avengers HQ appeared, I kind of thought, cool, are we going to get to see like Iron Man? And I thought they were going to kind of throw in. And I mean, I love Anthony Mackie. I love what he does with the Falcon, but it felt a bit like we got the sort of cheapest possible version of.
I thought it would have been really cool if he'd shrunk down and he'd broken in, and we'd just seen Ant-Man like sneaking around, running around, and you just see the Avengers, even if it's the new lineup. Just, you know, sitting around, relaxing, chatting, playing, playing Paul or something. And he sort of like goes through, and you know, what do they do when they're not saving the world and they just got a bit of downtime, you know, like firemen.
That would have been a big cheer. It felt a little bit, you kind of imagine what could have been with that scene.
Yeah.
Rather than going, this is
amazing. But I think if it had been that, we would have. That's actually a really nice idea. That would have been fun. But we know contractually speaking, they're not going to be able to make that happen.
I could do it with CG.
It's just not going
to
work.
Or you could have just had their legs, and you wouldn't have had to get the actors. And you could have just had all the, you know.
Yeah,
that would have been fun.
That's really fun.
Just running along the floor.
But I think, as Reed said, I think he also wanted a scene where he proves himself by fighting an Avenger. And actually, what it does. It puts Ant-Man on a level because, you know, at that point the movie's very fun and you're going, okay, ha ha ha, he's small and he's running away from rats and blah blah blah. But what it does is it shows that actually he's got serious potential and he can get inside someone's costume and dismantle him from within, and he can actually hold his own against, yeah, admittedly, maybe not one of the alpha Avengers, but yeah. I also think Mackie's a lot of fun. And as I said on our regular podcast, for me, that felt like you were reading an Ant-Man comic, and 10 pages in, the Falcon turns up, which happens all the time in Marvel Comics. And we never complain when it happens in the comic, but we seem to complain when it happens in the movies, which is the whole point of this universe in the first place.
Not complaining. The idea was nice.
But it just feels like he's turned up for 10 pages, they've had a fight, and he's left again. And also, it's a way in of introducing Ant-Man into the Avengers world, which is, I think, a fun way to go.
Mm. I like the reference to the end of Avengers: Age of Ultron, but maybe that it felt a bit sort of self-deprecating, possibly.
Yeah.
The, you know, all cities falling out. I can't remember the exact wording, but they're referring to the
too busy
the
dropping
fact
the
that every Marvel
out of the
film
sky.
For the last four has had a city being
or had something big falling out of the sky onto something.
Yeah, which I'm personally a little bit tired of, but I liked that little joke. Mm.
And there's a little Spider-Man reference, of course, which is the. Yes. The heralding, the introduction, really,
yeah.
of Spider-Man to the MCU.
Yeah, the Sokovia line felt a bit on the nose for me, I'll be honest. Because we were worried about it, I think, when we saw one of the trailers where he goes, but, you know, and Paul Rudd goes, okay, first things first, we should call the Avengers, which actually works a lot better in the film than it does in the trailer. But the Sokovia line was a little bit too far for me.
Talking of on the nose, I do actually like this, but there's a point where Darren Cross goes, "Tales to Astonish," which of course was the kind of the banner line for the Ant-Man comics.
That's where he made it. That's the comic he made his debut.
Yeah,
Tales
to Astonish. Tales to Astonish. It was fun. Yeah. I think it was deliberately silly.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's put there. If you know who Al Milgrom is, and the Milgrom Hotel will give you a laugh. That will give you a laugh. Stan Lee will give you a laugh. And if not, it's fine. I actually thought Darren Cross. Corey Stoll's a fantastic actor, with or without a wig. But I felt that Darren Cross was possibly the latest in a series of underwhelming MCU villains. Yeah. I think that's one of the few things they've really struggled to crack. Loki aside.
It's a guy wearing a different coloured suit to the hero.
He was ironmongery. At Comic-Con this year, David Ayer came out to introduce the Suicide Squad, and he made a not-so-subtle jab at Marvel by saying, we've got all the best, DC's got all the best villains, and... Corey Stoll is fun, and it's a fine villain. It's okay. I didn't. The one thing that confused me a little bit was: is he going mad?
It's that weird line that didn't really come from anywhere. Hmm. Like, which he says, it's the Pym particles that are affecting his mind. They're
but
making
why are they
make
not
him
affecting?
Mad.
And then there's another line where Hank Pym says, "Oh, I can't wear it too many times." Or
yeah, but they actually made that. The point of showing like the thing where they do the gag about the poor little lamb. Mm-hmm. And he's actually sealed off in a completely different room, and he actually says sterilize the area, etc., etc.
Yeah, but so, then he doesn't when and that's with the lamb that he succeeds in. He's actually exposed. He's in the room and he doesn't care anymore.
But he's already going mad before that.
Yeah, he's going mad before that. But that's just maybe because he's just. Bonkers?
But well, they put the line in the film.
There is a line which makes you think that he's not just going mad. I thought they should have just had him be just
experimented.
Evil.
Yeah.
And I kind of enjoyed, I mean, I'd like to see a supercut of scenes of evil executives doing things in executive bathrooms.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many times in movies is there someone villainous into a bathroom and does something evil?
It felt very Dick Jones to me. Yeah. That bit where he disintegrates poor Frank. Poor old Frank, who, you know, we all knew was for the chop the minute that Cross put his hand on his shoulder and went, Frank, we need to have a long talk about this. Mm. I just felt he was a bit grandstandy, and, you know, he was calculating when the movie needed him to be calculating, and he was dumb when it needed him to be dumb.
And but... who'd have thought that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, a businessman would be evil? I mean, you know.
I will give them kudos for making him actually fairly... evil in terms of what he does to lambs and actually squishing a guy. I kind of liked they pushed that quite far in terms of how evil he is.
Yeah.
But further than maybe I've seen in other Marvel films.
Yeah.
Where he just doesn't care. He'll kill anything.
He gets the yellow jacket suit on really quickly.
Yes. But so does Scott Lang get the Ant-Man suit on really quickly. There's the thing that the ants counting down 10, 9, 8 in the prison cell.
Yes.
And, you know, Avon Barksdale's walking
maybe
up.
Maybe it's minutes.
And then he walks up and then it's like, He's in the suit. What? How? You know, unless it's the Pym particles again.
It's the Pym particles. They allow the easy manipulation of a helmet.
They make the suit bigger, and then you put it on, and it shrinks to fit.
Yes. Absolutely. So Darren Cross is the main villain. One little Marvel Cinematic Universe tie-in as well that we haven't really mentioned is that those mother effers at Hydra are still knocking around. What? Will they ever die?
It's like a snake with loads of different heads. You, you cut one off and then it's still alive. And you cut another one off and it's still
and two
alive.
Two heads take its place. And yeah. Which almost never happens with a snake, but that would be really weird if that happened.
Yeah.
I actually quite like that. I quite like the fact also they were clearly low-level Hydra. But that makes sense. That makes sense because how many terrorist organizations can you truly destroy?
There's also apparently a reference to what is the name of the Mandarins?
The Ten Rings.
The Ten Rings, apparently, yeah. In one of the Michael Peña kind of flashbacky montages, you see the guy he was in prison with, and he's got a Ten Rings tattoo. Apparently, I didn't spot that myself, but that's what I heard.
That's what I heard. It's a word on the street.
Does this mean Gary Shandling is coming back? I hope so. God, I hope so.
Well, he got properly arrested at the end of Captain America, didn't he?
He'll be back. I love that Gary Shandling is floating around on the periphery of this universe as some kind of villainous senator. I do love that. Disney. There's a couple of Disney references in this movie.
Yeah.
Flounder from The Little Mermaid is in Cassie's room, the little girl's room.
Oh, I missed
that. Little toy. And the song that Michael Peña whistles.
Is The Small World After All.
Indeed.
That's right.
So there we go.
How lovely.
Isn't corporate synchronization a wonderful thing?
Corporate synchronicity is one of my favourite things.
That's a brand synergy high five, people. Brand synergy. Yeah. And you can enjoy this brand synergy as well in Empire Magazine, which is available in all Good and Evil newsagents, priced, I can't even remember what the price is.
£4.50.
That's very, very good. And of course, you can enjoy even more brand synergy on EmpireOnline.com, which is just wonderful. Right. So a couple more things to talk about before we go. We've talked about one sting. The wasp sting, but we haven't. I saw someone. Dan, I hate you. I don't know, actually genuinely don't know why we let you in the pop booth. Anyway, there's. I saw someone refer to post credit sting the other day on Twitter as secret endings, which I think is really sweet. I quite like that.
Secret endings.
So they're not post credit stings.
But they're not endings.
Secret endings.
They're not endings. Especially the one we're about to talk about.
This is true.
It's definitely not an ending.
All right.
It's so the middle of a scene.
The secret ending sounds like a very sleazy strip club.
I like secret endings. Stop treading on my dreams. Okay, so the final post-credits sting is a scene from Captain America Civil War where Cap and Falcon are in a room with Bucky. Now, this is interesting. And Bucky appears to have his arm crushed in a situation that requires someone who can get into small spaces.
Or Vision.
I was very confused by this. I'll be honest.
I think Vision might not be in
it. Did a car sort of land on his arm or something? Was he trying to change a tire?
He's in some sort of machine. And there's a line that I couldn't catch the first two times around. Again, Peyton Reed said it, but that's reiterated, which is they can't call Tony Stark because the Accords wouldn't let him intervene. So at this point in the movie, this is clearly at some point in Civil War where this is interesting to me because A, they found Bucky. B, he's on their side. C, something bad has happened. D, the schism has happened between Cap and Tony, and I got the sense that Cap and Falcon are on the run as well, so they can't call the Vision, who I imagine would not be on their team.
I see.
Yeah, I mean it was decent. It was intriguing, mildly intriguing, I guess. I was hoping for Spider-Man, and I was quite confused. It looked like they were in some kind of garage, and he'd got his arm stuck in a car, and I didn't understand anything that was going on.
I don't think you're meant to understand, Nick. I think you're meant to ask
questions.
Yeah,
but you're also meant to get excited by it, and it didn't quite work for me. It was a lot better than the Terminator Genesis sting, which is possibly the worst sting of all time. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, again, you guys weren't at the big multimedia, but people hang around now. I mean, they left at our screening, the small screen, but people do hang around for these stings. And the first sting, when the wasp suit is unveiled and Evangeline Lilly says about damn time, and that's mentioned as well, that's a promise of another female superhero in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and that's a great thing. So about damn time is loaded with meaning as well. That got a huge cheer. People seem to be absolutely nuts for that, and I think that shows that they really connected with that character and they're really intrigued by what the wasp could do. And then the second sting got a huge reaction. First of all, when you hear the words Cap, and then when Chris Evans appeared, that people went nuts for that. But I think people were genuinely excited about that, Nick. I think people are genuinely intrigued to see what the hell has happened in Civil War before that scene, to bring that to make the events of that scene come about.
Okay,
I was nonplussed.
Okay,
two nonplussed.
You were hoping to be plussed.
Yes, but
two
nonplusses
make a positive. So you're both plussed.
I was much more excited by Thomas the Tank Engine. I'm going to drop one final fact for this podcast.
Okay, go on.
Oh, man, you're a fact machine. Go on, fact me up.
It's a fact in four parts, because I'm going to name the four carriages that you see behind Thomas the Tank Engine.
Wait. Jeff.
Jeff is not one of them.
Oh, well, Annie and Clarabelle, everyone knows those.
Annie and Clarabelle.
No, I didn't know that.
What?
I have no Thomas the Tank Engine knowledge. I know that there's a tank engine and he's called Thomas and he hangs around with a fat guy.
And he lives
that's all I know.
He lives on the island of Sodor.
Don't know that.
You also see Emily, the brake coach, and Emily, the composite coach. That's my final fact. I'm going out in style.
That's a huge fact. I mean, I don't know if I can deal with facts that huge. I'm not even sure if we should... We should probably just end the podcast now, to be honest. I think we talked about everything, haven't we?
Yeah.
I don't, when you have a fact bomb that big.
I've got one more last question.
Okay, go on.
Okay. There's a giant fucking ant running around. It's the size of a fucking dog.
Okay.
And
earmuffs,
it's running
language.
Around. What the fuck?
Okay, that's three F-bombs, Dan. You know, people might be playing this to their kids. And they're an hour into the podcast. And then Dan's gone red band. I mean, what's up with that?
Red Ant Band.
Oh, Dan, you're an absolute imbecile.
He truly is Ant Dan.
I'm sorry, but you can't just, oh, look, it's the new family pet. I mean, I know it's a funny film. It's a funny film, but that's just wrong.
It's not wrong.
That thing's going to kill that girl.
It's not going to kill that girl.
Its mandibles are going to be snipping her legs off at the knees.
It's
going to be destroying her. It's a monster. It should be killed.
Dan, you have issues which cannot be resolved in this pod booth, but should be attended to.
Shall we resolve some more issues, just very briefly then, as a better way to finish the podcast? Let's look to the future, because the movie ends with the line, Ant-Man will return, and we know that Paul Rudd will be in Captain America Civil War, and we know that he'll probably team up with Falcon and Cap to free Bucky from the giant vice that he's in, whatever the hell's happened there. You know, this movie, I don't know how it's going to do at the box office. We've recorded it beforehand, but they're projecting a $60 million opening weekend. They're, you know, I guess it's going to make enough for a sequel, but it's probably going to make first Captain America, first Thor money worldwide. So then Marvel, I guess, always hope that the second movie people will be familiar with the characters, the concept. But it's not going to be Avengers or Guardians of the Galaxy.
I don't underestimate how much people like shrinking.
Well, I don't like
shrinking.
I prefer enlarging personally.
Yeah, no. The idea of shrinking is just like you don't need to have the knowledge of the character or any of this business to just be into the idea of a superhero who shrinks really small. Kids love that,
and the marketing for this has been pretty
very focused on that. So yeah. I actually think it's going to do better. I think it should be. You could push Guardians.
But we haven't mentioned the
Guardians numbers.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned the effects at all, by the way. And we should say that the macro photography, which is how they did the shrinking stuff, they actually filmed every set that they were going to have a shrinking scene on with these amazing cameras. I watched them do a bathtub, and that's all real stuff. That's not VFX. That's the obviously, you know, they use effects to get him in there. But he's running around. Those are real cracks and stuff. They didn't use any oversized props. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it looked really good. I thought the bath scene in particular.
Yes.
Do you think we're only going to see Ant-Man now in other people's movies, or do you think that Marvel will commit now to an Ant-Man 2, which they haven't announced yet? I mean, they've got their slate up to 2019, but as Kevin Feige has said, and as they've already proven with Spider-Man, they can move things around.
Well, I have an inside source.
Okay.
Two words.
Yes.
Jurassic Ant.
Yes.
Doctor Wu shrinks dinosaurs, and Paul Rudd has to fight them.
Well... How have they not made this movie already? What's going on?
That sounds awesome.
You're on board. You don't like big ants, but you like small dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dan loves dinosaurs.
I would love to have a pet Tyrannosaurus Rex that is the size of a cat. But I would not like to have a pet ant that is the size of a dog.
If nothing else, we've figured that out, and that's a wonderful thing.
On that hatred-filled bombshell, that's it for our Ant-Man spoiler special. Our next spoiler special is going to be probably Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, with writer-director Christopher McQuarrie spilling all the beans. If that happens, it's going to be out early August, just after the film comes out. And of course, do listen, if you don't already, to the regular Empire podcast every Friday. We would appreciate that, of course. Until the regular podcast, or the spoiler one, it's goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to mourn Anthony, who was taken from us too soon. Rest in peace, little guy. Rest in peace.